Oh.
I'm afraid you're not gonna see me from this side, so I can see you guys, but I've just gotten up, so I haven't had my shower or anything else, so you have to deal with my voice and not my face.
Okay,
no problem.
Thank you.
Is it okay with you if we record this interview?
Okay,
cool.
Thanks.
Well, first of all, thank you for agreeing to conduct this interview with us. Maybe we'll start off by you telling a little bit about you, I mean the work you do on national and international level.
Okay. But maybe you guys introduce yourselves.
Yeah, sure. We can do that too.
Okay.
We're a study research group who are competing in an IGEM competition that's conducted by the Massachusetts Institute of
Technology.
Exactly, thank you.
Yep.
And we're from Hamburg, Germany.
Okay.
So basically what we do is we have the support of our professors here at the university, and we design an application or an experiment, a project basically, and then we go through with it for a year, and then at the end we present the results at the MIT in Boston.
Okay.
And for our project we decided to develop an application to affordably diagnose chlamydia or chlamydial bacteria in microfluidic devices, which are like lab-on-a-chip devices which can be easily produced. And the key point here is that we are working with nanoscientists within our group to actually make these devices affordable, so people can buy them for 10 to 15 cents in euro.
Okay.
And that's basically it. What we're doing is we're using bacteria and we're transforming them with a receptor that's specific for a molecule in the cell wall of chlamydia, which is called MDAP, mesodiaminopimelic acid. And we are also integrating a signaling pathway, so when the receptor binds this molecule, which is mostly specific to chlamydial bacteria, then the signaling cascade is activated and a light signal is induced, which you can then measure. So the idea is to take these diagnostic bacteria and immobilize them on these microfluidic chips, which are for lab safety and for easy handling.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can insert the patient sample, and the idea is that if they're infected, you get a diagnosis. I mean,
yeah.
The doctor can.
And the advantages, for example, that you don't have to pre-treat the sample that you have to inject, so you can just take whatever sample you have, and if there are chlamydia in it, hopefully we can detect them.
Okay.
Yeah, and we also are trying to design a lab on a phone device, so we think that would be great that in the end you could just put the chip inside a device that is on the downside of your mobile phone.
Right.
And then the camera detects the fluorescence signal for you. So that would be very easy and straightforward way to get the results from the test.
Okay.
Yeah.
And maybe we should also introduce myself. This is
Hi,
I'm Daniel, and this is Nico.
Hi.
Hi. Okay,
we're
great.
All
I was hoping you would have some real name introductions, that's good. So what is your own personal background? I mean, it sounds like you're coming at this from, biotechnology background.
Yes.
Are you all students in biotechnology in Hamburg, or?
We are still students in molecular life science and nanotechnology.
Okay.
So it's mostly biochemistry, maybe biomedicine a bit, and then we have a few members of our group.
Well, considerable amount of nanoscientists who are doing the generation of the microfluidic devices, which are very technical.
And have you, thinking about this from a standpoint of like of a point of care diagnostic system, is that right?
Yeah, definitely. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And are you're familiar with the point of care work that was done in the past by, I think it was Cambridge?
No.
It was not successful, so that's an easy one.
Okay.
They did some point of care diagnostic work. In fact, they did it in Tanzania and near our facility, and we helped with some of that. In the end, it was not successful, and I can find some of that documentation and send it on to you.
That would be great. Yes,
please.
BBC actually did a little piece. So if you look on the BBC, I was interviewed, and I'm not sure if you use my name under BBC whether it would pick it up or not. But anyways, I'll look for that and send that on to you. That would have been probably around 2000, and I'm going to guess 2004 or 5, somewhere in that range.
Okay.
And I'm blanking right now on the names of the researchers, but anyway, I'll look for that and send it on to you guys.
Yeah, that would be cool.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
Okay.
The reason we actually wanted to interview you was because for the iGEM project, we also have to do the so-called human practices part, and we're trying to design an application scenario. So we want to just find out how well our device could be used in developing countries, and if there is a need for a device like that.
Doing some basic social studies to check the field and also to see what kind of resources doctors in the field have available, so we can design our device accordingly.
Okay.
I'm actually looking at an article right now where you're talking about Helen Lee and Claude Edouard Mickel from Cambridge.
That is it.
Because we just researched a little bit. But I mean, in the article which we found, which is in German actually, a semi-scientific article, it says that the sensitivity was actually higher than previous diagnostic tests. So why did it fail?
It worked well when Cloud did the assess the specimens in the field at that point of care time, but when they tried to train other people on assessing it in the field, it failed. It was too specific to one individual being able to read it in the field.
Okay, so it was not reproducible.
Correct.
Okay.
So, and what I can do is find that documentation that addressed it. I don't think they put it out as a publication. I think it came out more from some internal communication.
Okay.
So, what you probably find in the literature is where it was successful. What you're probably not finding is that it did not lead anywhere down the line because the actual application was not successful.
Yeah.
Anyways, I'll look for that stuff.
Yeah.
I'll give you a bit of my background. So I'm an epidemiologist by training.
Mm-hmm.
I've done primarily ocular epidemiology since my training.
Yeah.
And, I'm not an MD. My background before doing my PhD was in the field of education and also in the field of international health.
Okay.
Yes.
So
Where did you live in Africa for those 20 years?
So, it would have been 1 year in Ethiopia, 4 years in Malawi, 11 years in Tanzania, 4 years in South Africa.
Wow, not bad. Then you really must have like an overview of how the chlamydia endemic works in different countries within Africa.
Yeah, and I have to visit all the nine countries, which are Tanzania, Ethiopia, Uganda, Kenya, Mozambique, Malawi, Chad, Nigeria. I'm missing one. Zambia. I visit all of those countries at least once a year, and I've worked with all those folks for many, many years. I'm also involved with assisting Eritrea, Sudan, Yemen. I'm now helping Vietnam get their dossier for declaration of, or verification of elimination, and the same for Nepal. So, yeah, it's I have a pretty good sense of what's going on in the field. I would say that, yeah.
So, I mean, it's difficult for us to judge. So we want to ask you, what are the main factors actually contributing to chlamydia in those countries? Or to chlamydial infection?
To chlamydial infection. I mean, the transmission, of course, is very focal. And if one looks throughout Africa, a mistake that was made in the past was to just, you know, kind of paint all places red if they found trachoma in one particular area of the country. That was an error, and it's only more recently with all of the global trachoma mapping project that it's really clarified where chlamydia transmission is really a problem and where it's not. So, as an example, in Tanzania, you know, there's, I don't know, maybe 150 some odd districts, but in fact, right now, there's probably only five districts in which transmission is at such a level that there needs to be concerted effort at reducing transmission and tackling the disease. Ethiopia, on the other hand, is, you know, I would say the number of districts there that need intervention is probably over 150. So it's very focal, and I think that is one of the things we've had to learn is that we have to bring the programs down to a, you know, area by area, and even within an area, we have to look much more carefully at where transmission is happening.
Okay.
So the programs that are in place, although they are focused on a district, and a district can be, you know, 100,000 to 300,000 people, there's a bit of kind of over-treatment right now in some areas.
Okay.
Because that entire district does not really have a problem, but it is focal even within that district. So that is something that is probably, I would say, it's something we struggle with, is a bit of over-treatment in some areas. And then in other areas, probably under-treatment. And we have focal areas, I'll give you an example, around Kilimanjaro. We have districts that include the upland areas around Mount Kilimanjaro, but then also the Maasai steppe at the lower ends of Kilimanjaro. Now, the population density is highest up on the upper slopes of Kilimanjaro rather than down the flatlands, which is more of a hot, dry area. And that Maasai steppe, trachoma in those communities is a serious problem, but when you take and do a survey of a administrative district, the findings from the slopes basically washes out the findings from the actually missing populations that are not being treated.
Uh-huh.
And this is a problem in certain areas. So I think that there's still a lot of lessons that we need to learn if we're going to eliminate this disease. Mm-hmm. And our surveys, although they're good for what they were designed for, they do miss out. And I think we need other tools to make some decisions.
I'm glad that you started talking about this. We read through some of the regional case study summaries, also of the GET 2020 reports, which also talked a lot about regions. Are you familiar with GET 2020?
Oh, yeah.
So you were also active in GET 2020?
Yep.
Can you tell us more or less what you did associated with the WHO?
Well, I mean, GET 2020 is really an alliance so that WHO leads the group, but it's an alliance of organizations, you know, like KCCO, ministries of health and all of that, from a standpoint of, well, you have to talk about the past versus the present. From the standpoint of the present, GET 2020 is much more active and muscular, which is great, in terms of trying to provide the guidance. It doesn't provide any money. It's really the guidance for what programs and countries need to do to reach their elimination. So there's a new documentation on what countries need to do to verify elimination, for example.
Okay.
And that's what GET 2020 does. Mm-hmm. And what GET 2020 has also done is work through organizations, because they don't really have any money, but work through organizations like KCCO to have like scientific meetings. And so KCCO organized for GET 2020 both the first and then most recently the second global trichiasis scientific meeting. So it's something that KCCO organizes but it's under GET 2020 as an initiative, so that the findings from it then gets applied globally. So our role has been to provide some of the scientific backstopping and some of the coordination for kind of overall GET 2020 activities.
Which means that you probably have a very good overview of the progress GET 2020 has made. I mean, global elimination of trachoma until 2020 is an ambitious goal. Do you think they will reach it?
Well, I would say yes and no. Yes, in many of the countries, I think countries like Malawi and Mozambique and Nepal and these countries, even Tanzania, I think that yes, they will achieve it. They will achieve it by the year 2020. Some countries, Ethiopia is an example, probably not, just because the problem there is so massive. Other countries like South Sudan that are still in a, you know, conflict stage, clearly it's not, because there's really nothing going on there or very little going on. So, you know, if people say that global elimination means that every country has to be at that level, then they're not going to achieve it. I don't personally subscribe to that perspective, because I think if you know, the vast majority of countries have achieved it, and we just have a few countries left that have not, and there are reasons why it is not, then I still think that celebration can occur. The fear, of course, is that if people start celebrating and then the donors say, well, okay, I guess we don't need to invest anymore, then we have a problem. And that's kind of what happened with leprosy, you know, back in the early 2000s.
Talking about reasons why some countries still continue or might continue to have trachoma cases beyond 2020, what do you think are the main reasons for, I mean, aside from conflict in, for example, South Sudan and other countries, that this goal might not be achieved?
You know, I don't have an easy answer for that one. It's a question that the whole trachoma community is struggling with, particularly in terms of Ethiopia. And as you might be aware, Amhara region in Ethiopia has had antibiotic treatment in many of those districts for 7, 8, 9, maybe even 10 years. And yet the prevalence of TF in those regions is still quite high. The Ministry of Health in Ethiopia is really very concerned about it, and rightfully so. So what is likely to happen fairly soon is commissioning a much more in-depth assessment of the situation to try to answer the question that you're asking. Why is Amhara, with so many years of antibiotic treatment, not achieving lower prevalence rates for TF herbs, you know, below WHO threshold? I mean, I think many people would give you their ideas as to why that's the case, but I think getting kind of a global assessment of this will be helpful, because then it kind of pulls in everybody's perspectives on what is likely to be the gaps. My personal feeling is the inadequate attention to transmission, meaning that are the programs to reduce transmission, whether it be through latrine construction, use of latrines, clean faces, other approaches to reduce transmission, are those approaches adequate? My sense is probably not. That said, I see other countries that also don't have what I would call really robust WASH programs, and yet, you know, active trachoma has decreased significantly. So what is unique about Amhara, for example? And I don't have an easy answer for that one right now, but I do think it has to do with transmission one way or the other. And what is going on, that is still unclear.
So would you think that, for example, our diagnostic device would be helpful to reduce the burden in such areas?
Yeah. Especially the financial burden, because the main point is that it's affordable.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, a little bit of history here. The ITI has supported the Carter Center to set up a laboratory facility in Bahadur in order to, you know, run a whole bunch of laboratory tests to look at infection in that setting. I mean, it's taken years and years and years to get it set up, and I think it is
that's exactly the point of our project, which is so if we are successful.
Well, you know, I do see there is a role for better tools for diagnosis of infection, particularly in settings where we are unclear as to what is going on. And, you know, Ethiopia stands out as the primary place for trying to figure out what is going on.
Yeah. Can you give us a rough outline of how that looks like in the field? I mean, do you do general screenings of the white population, or do you do small samples? What's the range of statistics that you gather?
Well, it's not that I've gathered. I mean, the Carter Center, with support from ITI, has actually taken both approaches. They've done some initial small studies in, you know, focal areas, but they've also, as part of their programs, collected specimens more broad-based. An additional challenge has been that these specimens have been stored for quite a while, and as you might imagine, there's been a breakdown in the quality of the specimen, so that at the end of the day, when they run these specimens, are we actually getting, you know, a correct reading, or have the specimens been degraded so much that they're useless?
When you talk about how
does one assess that? So there's a lot of data there. How meaningful the data is, how it can be used, is completely open for question. So new tools, in my mind, would be most welcome.
When you were talking about specimens, I just want to clarify, what did you mean by that?
In the settings in Ethiopia, I'm actually trying to remember now what type of specimens that they took, whether they were serum specimens or whether they took swabs, you know, conjunctival swabs. I'll have to go back and look back on my notes. I can't remember right now, but I'm going to guess it would have been conjunctival swabs, simply because taking serum specimens would be much more invasive and would be much, you know, more challenging to do. Yeah. So it's probably conjunctival swabs.
Yeah. Talking about the range of data that is gathered in different regions to assess the chlamydial endemic, how does it look with funding? I mean, is it tight in those programs? So do you have to turn each buck, or?
Sorry, say that again?
How is the funding in those programs? I mean, do you have to, in the programs, decision makers, do they have to decide, okay, which approach are we going, because we have to turn each dollar, we have to watch every expense?
Well, there's different funding mechanisms in place. So from the standpoint of the funding that is made possible through the UK government, it is tied to doing impact surveys. And you can learn more about that through a program that's called Tropical Data, and it's being organized through WHO, and that tropical data is really to provide the tools for doing impact surveys or U.S. government. And that's all fine and dandy. The trouble is that when we're talking about like Amhara, where it has continued way beyond the anticipated funding envelope, there's a challenge in getting additional money to continue doing MDA. Donors say, well, wait a minute, you know, we've been paying for this for how many years now? So it is, and for most countries, it's not been an issue because they've seen the prevalence of trachoma drop. And so then the donor has said, great, okay, if they end up one more year or maybe a couple more years, there's been no problem with donors poning up the additional money. The problem has been in a place like Ethiopia where we've been looking at many, many more years of treatment. So that's where I think we're going to have much more challenging issues. We have challenging issues now, and it will become even more problematic in the future if we don't understand what's going on.
Thank you a lot. We just have one or two final questions talking about awareness. So do you know, I mean, I'm not sure, but can you talk a little bit about how aware people are, maybe in the States or in Western countries in general, as opposed to other countries, in developing countries, for example? So is there a difference in awareness about chlamydia?
I would say, well, since I haven't lived in America in so long, it's kind of hard for me to comment about here, but I think generally speaking, there's not a lot of awareness about trachoma or chlamydia. And I think most people are, you know, their focus when they think about healthcare in developing countries kind of comes back to the biggies like malaria, HIV, AIDS, and TB. Chlamydia and trachoma generally don't pop up on the radar screen. I always found it interesting in a lot of developing countries early on, because there was money, it's a long time ago, focused on trachoma as a blinding condition, that in many countries you'd ask them, what is your leading cause of blindness? And they'd say trachoma. And you'd go, well, no, that's actually not true. And that's often because there was advocacy for identification of trachoma as a cause of blindness and for implementation of programs. I think there's a much greater understanding of where trachoma fits in terms of causes of blindness in developing countries, but in industrialized, I think there's very little understanding. That doesn't mean that it should be, you know, I don't think it deserves a huge amount of pressure for advocacy within the developed world, simply because it's not the leading cause of blindness. It doesn't kill people. I mean, probably speaking against my own better interests and saying it's not going to draw, you know, huge donor dollars, and probably shouldn't, because it's not as big of a problem as many of the other health conditions that exist in these places.
Actually, I was expecting you to say the opposite, because you were living in Africa for so long, and we always imagined that maybe in the Western countries it is just underrepresented, and in African countries, I mean, it still affects people and it blinds people and it's easy to treat, but it just doesn't have much attention.
Well, see, one of the issues, and when you say it's easy to treat, the technology is there, yes, but when we say easy to treat, I think many people in the industrialized world forget that a lot of what makes it difficult to treat is actually not the technology, but it's the management systems and the health systems that would fine and cool and technology really attractive, but how you actually implement those is often the bigger challenge. And so it kind of goes back to that statement that people are often happy to talk about a magic bullet, but in fact, what we often need in many places in Africa is the magic gun. If you got magic bullets, but you don't have the magic gun, you know, the magic bullets frankly just stay on the shelf. So if we don't invest in ensuring that the systems are strong enough to support it, then it could end up being just a nice little, you know, piece of technology that doesn't get really used appropriately.
We also have a quick question about demographics, because you were talking about different regions. So are there differences in infection between rural and urban areas, or between the young and the old, or something like that?
Well, with trachoma, certainly yes. So, I mean, it is a disease most in rural areas rather than urban, but even in rural areas, it's quite focal. So you would not just say rural areas and leave it at that. You really have to look much more specifically. And certainly in terms of transmission, we're looking at the highest transmission is in preschool children. And then it starts dropping, you know, as you start looking at ages 5, 6, and 7, it starts dropping quite rapidly. So highest transmission rates are going to be in kids, let's say, age 2, 3 years of age, rather than in the older children. So.
And what would be the reason for that, for them to get more likely infected?
Well, it's children at that age are not, they don't engage in any kind of personal hygienic, you know, practices. They don't wash their own face. They're not concerned about the flies that are landing on around their eyes. It requires somebody else to take care of them. When a child gets about 5 or 6, they generally start taking on those roles themselves. I think the other interesting thing, which you may be aware of, is that although transmission in young children is pretty much the same boys versus girls, however, if you look at the prevalence of trichiasis, you know, the interred eyelashes in adults, women generally have about a 1.8 to 2-fold excess prevalence of trichiasis compared to men. And the reason for that is that women get infected later in life by their, you know, by what's going on within their children because of their role as caretakers of the kids. So that we actually have kind of two different periods when we have a lot of infection between and among preschool children, and then to moms later on when they are taking care of those preschool kids.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
Yeah, my last question would be, if you just would focus on these two groups with a diagnostic tool and just diagnose them, even though you have no indication, would that be useful, or would that just be a waste of money and time? Maybe?
So do you mean diagnosis just without any kind of other clinical sign? Is that what you're?
Yes. Just, I don't know how.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. That would be the quick and easy answer, because we often struggle to identify the connection between the clinical disease and infection. So somebody may be infected, but they're not manifesting with the clinical disease yet.
Okay.
And at that point in time, there is definitely value in diagnosis of infection, so it can be managed. And at the same time, you may find clinical disease, but there's no longer infection because, you know, the infection happened, you know, do we end up with focal conditions and where there's still infection going on? And can we pick that up quickly and to treat it quickly before it leads to a recrudescence of disease? Because that's always the concern we have, is that, you know, we can see that prevalence of clinical disease drops, but we know it's not geographically even. There will be some areas there still may be more infection going on. Are there tools which can be used to help identify those focal areas quickly and easily, so that interventions can be done much quicker, and therefore does not lead to a recrudescence of disease throughout an entire district, for example?
Okay. Yeah. Do you still have any questions for us?
Well, not really at this stage. It sounds like you guys are working on something that has some value for the field, so I just wish you good luck on that. And
thanks again for the interview. Maybe we'll stay in contact. Maybe you or we have some other questions. And yeah, have a good morning, I guess.
Thank you, and have a good evening there.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.